This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Merry Christmas, one and all. Is that controversial to say now? We'll examine that in a second on Tactics. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Tactics. It is great to be with you on this Thursday morning. Always a pleasure to get to be able to talk to you, and I'm excited about today, although I will have to go ahead and let you know that there will not be any more shows after tomorrow for the rest of the year, because I'll be going through chemotherapy again. I've got another full week. This is my last week, so today and probably tomorrow, should be in tomorrow if everything goes according to plan. That is what we're looking at right now, but very well could be the last show of the year, so it's time to make it count. Now, I saw this story just the other day, and just to give you a little context, a little background, let you know what is going on. Every year, the White House, regardless of who's in office, puts out an official Christmas card, and they send it to different people. In this particular case, there was a bit of controversy stirred up because for the duration of the Obama administration, their card said Happy Holidays. This year, when the official Christmas card came out, the Trump family's picture was there and it read Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. So in breaking with the tradition, it had always been Merry Christmas before the Obamas, so far as I know. I don't know about Bush's, but this whole Merry Christmas versus Happy Holidays thing kind of started right around the time that Bush was leaving office, so I imagine it was probably Merry Christmas for most of the Bush years. The Obamas felt that they would want to transition to Happy Holidays, and so the Trump card this year said, Trump card, play on words there. The Trump card said Merry Christmas instead. Well, once word of this got out, Twitter exploded. The internet was always wanting to jump in and comment on this. This was something that was apparently a really big deal, got blown way out of proportion. There were a lot of responses to the official announcement on Twitter where Trump and his family had done this, and one response, my favorite, was a very poorly constructed and grammatically incorrect meme that read this way. I'll correct the grammar myself. Why do I wish people happy holidays? Because from November 1st to January 15th, there are 29 holidays observed by 7 of the world's major religions, and I don't think mine are the only ones that count. Now, I'll go ahead and say this. I'm not offended by, nor does it bother me when people say happy holidays. Some people feel that that's more generic, that they're being more inclusive by doing so. I don't really care, to be honest. That's fine if that's what you want to do. It does not bother me or get under my skin in any way. And to give you a little bit of context right out of the gate, I don't have much of a dog in this fight. Not because I don't celebrate Christmas, but because I'm a little different than a lot of Christians. The vast majority of Christians, of course, celebrate Christmas as Christ's birth. I just celebrate it as kind of a secular holiday because there's not really any evidence that Christ was born in December. In fact, the evidence leads stronger to believe that it was sometime in the warmer months in the spring or summer when the shepherds would have been out watching over their flocks during the night. But it's just not something that I celebrate. There are plenty of Christians that do, and I don't begrudge them for that. That's perfectly fine if they feel that focusing on specifically the birth story of the narrative in the Gospels is something that helps them spiritually. I kind of go by the Romans 14 rule there, which is some people esteem some days better than others and let them do it to the glory of God, and for those who don't, let them esteem every day. So I just believe we celebrate Christ's life every day and that it's not necessarily spiritually productive for me to do so. But I don't begrudge any of the Christians that do. So I'm a little bit different, just so y'all know where I'm coming from on this. But here's the problem with that meme. It does suppose something. It makes an assumption right out of the gate, which is anyone that greets you with a holiday greeting of their choosing, whether someone says Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, I don't know, Kwanzaa, or whatever else there is around this time of year, that they are, in doing so, saying, my holidays matter, yours don't. They assume that anybody using that greeting is trying to stick a finger in your eye and say, well, my holidays are the only ones that count. But there's no reason to believe that. And that's the issue that I have with this whole premise. The reason that I read it is because I think it's a great little summary, a synopsis of the reason that people get all upset and get their hair all up in a dander because they're worried about the other person trying to assert, I guess, their religion or their holiday over the one that they choose. That's typically not why people greet each other with that. I guess theoretically sometimes someone could do that, and if they do that, then they're wrong regardless of what religion they claim, because that's not a very productive thing to do, regardless of your religion. But at the same time, let's observe that. The vast, vast, vast majority of people, if someone were to walk up to me and say Happy Hanukkah, it wouldn't bother me. I mean, I'm not going to celebrate Hanukkah because I'm not Jewish, but it wouldn't get under my skin, and I wouldn't assume that the person is trying to malign me in any way. In fact, I would take it as that person is just trying to be friendly. And so that's really the issue that we have here at the core of this entire argument, is that you have one side that assumes it's just a nice thing to do and are trying to actually be inclusive instead of exclusive. For example, we talk about being inclusive. Well, wouldn't being inclusive mean you say the same thing to everybody? That you're trying to include them in your celebration? That you're including them in your well wishes? Really, that would be inclusive. By saying to someone Merry Christmas and not walking on eggshells around them. That doesn't mean you're trying to alienate them. If anything, it's trying to do the opposite. And the irony in all this is the left's gross overreaction to something as relatively benign as saying Merry Christmas on a Christmas card. And that is what really got Trump elected in the first place. Not the Christmas card thing specifically, but the fact that Trump just does something relatively normal and the left loses their mind over it because he knows it's not politically correct, but he just does it anyway, and then the left loses their mind. That's actually the same kind of thing that got Trump to the White House in the first place. Now, granted, that's not a good reason to elect someone, and I was saying that the entire primary, but it is part of the reason all the same, that Trump just spoke his mind, and the left freaked out about it. And because the left freaked out about it so much, a lot of people were saying, this is the guy we need. Now, again, I disagree with that reasoning, but the point is, it is one of the major reasons that he wound up getting the nomination. And I will say that one of the few things that Trump fans and Trump skeptics like myself find some common ground and agree on is that we've got to stop this PC culture. Because it is absolutely alienating people and driving us into different segments of society. It's dividing us as a people, and it's not productive. Most of the time, it's destructive. See, to the left, the only sin is offending anybody that isn't a white Christian male. As long as you have some kind of quote-unquote minority status, which I never really fully understood why being female is a minority status, it's literally half the population, but anyway, as long as you have some kind of minority status, then you can't offend that person, but anyone who's in the majority, it's perfectly all right to offend them, or to ask them to completely change their behavior to accommodate somebody else. And so that's one thing that people do get tired of, is when you're looking at this and looking at the kinds of things, when it's as though it's the majority that's always in the wrong with the left. Being in the majority doesn't automatically make you wrong. And it also doesn't mean you're automatically hurting anybody in the minority. And so it's these little episodes like this that absolutely drive the left up a wall. And that's part of the reason that the people who elected Trump like him. Because he just does what he thinks he should do, and the left freaks out about it. If the left would just moderate their tone a little bit, and I say this as somebody who maybe didn't moderate his tone enough during the Obama administration, and maybe that was a mistake, but if the left would just moderate their tone a little bit, not get bent out of shape over every little thing, and come off as a reasonable, logical, responsible adult, then maybe we could start having some of these discussions. And maybe it wouldn't be taken the wrong way when they're trying to be more inclusive. Now, we can have that discussion whether one's right or one's not, but it's hard to have a discussion with somebody that's in a constant rage mode. And I'm not saying everybody on the left is like that. I know they're not. There are people that you can have reasonable discussions with, and when we find those people, that's when we can really start making a difference. A little more on this Christmas thing when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor. George Washington.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. At Tactics Radio is the Twitter handle. If you want to get in touch with me that way, you can do that as well. I found this really interesting piece out of the Federalist, and I encourage you to read the whole thing yourself, but I'm going to read a large chunk of it here on the air today because I think it's that important. The headline is, I turned my coworker into HR when she gave me a Christmas card and she changed my heart. This is by Chad Felix Green of The Federalist. For years I have been one of the only Jewish people at my places of employment. I am currently the only Jew who wears a kippah in my office every day. My heavily Southern Baptist and rural town, one would think I would be quite familiar with the consequences of being such an outsider. But as any honest minority will tell you, that singular idea of what America must be like simply is not accurate. This image often lives exclusively in the minds of those intent on viewing the world as a hostile place filled with bigotry. This reminds me of a woman who illustrates the disconnect perfectly. For a long time, in my early working years, I felt extremely uncomfortable around Christmas time. I was far more liberal then and was far more suspicious of Christians around me. I would walk around listening to Christmas music while attempting to block out all religious connotations. I would drive past nativity scenes on public property and scowl at their imposition of Christian faith on everybody. I bitterly frowned at the lack of Hanukkah-related decorations at local stores. I felt completely outside of society, looking in from the cold at happy families eating their large Christmas dinners. An older woman who worked with me then gave me a personalized Christmas card each year. The card even had a small hand-placed candy attached. The first time she gave me the card, I instantly frowned with disapproval as the cover featured a glittery nativity scene. I tossed the card aside and shook my head at her, utter lack of respect for my religious beliefs. She did not seem to notice. The following year, she did the same with another religiously inspired card bearing another carefully placed candy, with a rosy smile as she handed each out. In secret, I wanted to enjoy her gifts. I would even sneakily eat the candy, hoping that no one would notice. I instinctively smiled inside, only to force a frown on the outside, purely on principle. I often convinced myself that even if I wasn't that offended, other people might be, and it was my responsibility to speak up for them. I felt a social obligation to educate her on the inappropriateness of her actions. While inside, I intermediately felt envious of those who fully enjoyed them. In my loneliness, her act of kindness gave me a moment of comfort. I chose to replace that with resentment. She was otherwise a lovely woman whom I generally enjoyed, but I viewed her as the object of validation to my belief in a totalitarian fascistic Christian right attempting to take over the country. Her sheer audacity in providing me with a clearly religious symbol, I felt like an intentional assault. And in the third year, I anticipated it with hostility. When she once again presented me with the hand-signed card, I stood up and marched to Human Resources, waving it in the air as evidence of being discriminated against. I angrily complained that her intentions did not matter as long as I felt the offense, and the act itself made me working there feel unsafe. So I spoke to her about the issue. Now, it goes on, and like I said, I'm going to read another little piece of it, but this goes back to the mindset that we were just discussing, that some people really do walk this earth looking for things to be offended by and see the world as the author here puts it, a hostile place that is filled with bigotry. We must also be careful and try to give people the benefit of the doubt that when they extend a hand of kindness to us, we don't take it the wrong way. So I want to go ahead and read the last little part of this segment. Sometimes those Hanukkah gifts have images of Jesus on them. Despite what our media presents and my younger self firmly believed, this is not an act of aggression but one of innocent compassion. A person who gives a gift featuring his or her sacred religious iconography is reaching out, showing kindness, and sharing his or her faith with others. These days I find myself loving Christmas and the cheer, colors, sounds, and small acts of kindness surrounding me. People love to make other people smile and do so with handcrafted gifts, treats, and homemade goods. They relish in watching the people that they engage with daily partake in delicious candy and cookies and eagerly post cards that have received all around doorways and walls. I still receive Christmas cards with nativity scenes on them, and they line my desk and doorframe with pride. I appreciate the gifts others give me now, and I know it is always with the best of intentions of heart. It is so easy to be offended, to feel hostile and suspicious. Victimhood is attractive because it gives people permission to be judgmental without the consequence of feeling superior in doing so. It creates a sense of being special, enlightened, and above all. But this merely traps people in a cycle of bitterness and loneliness as they fight the urge to simply enjoy the holiday season with everybody else. Ironically, the fact that they receive the same gift as everyone else demonstrates the inclusion in the group rather than highlighting the difference. As a Jew, I can say that I appreciate Christians' gestures during this time of the year. Although it has become risky over time, I encourage Christians to continue providing them. That kind of woman could have ignored me after that first year when I threw her card in the trash in open sight, but she didn't, and that matters. Kindness matters. Even with the objects of your kindness reject your efforts, just know that deep down you are touching a part of them that will hopefully come to appreciate it in time. Not everyone will, but just enough of us can be rescued and are worth the effort. Your small acts of generosity mean more than you know. This is a really great piece that ought to be posted in every break room in America, because it really does get to the heart of the matter. That one of the ways to find yourself and to be truly happy in life is to just assume the best in other people. No jealousy, no bitterness. Don't just assume that they're out to get you or they want to do you some kind of harm. Just assume the best in people. That really does make a difference. And I think that you see, going through this guy's story, there is a large difference in the wisdom and maturity that he developed in his earlier years and later on. He was happier once he started looking for the good in people instead of just assuming that they had ill intention. And I think as Christians, it's important for us to do this, to see the best in others, to assume the best. Isn't that kind of the key theme of Christmas anyway? Peace and goodwill towards men? That we try to see the best in each other whenever we can? I've always thought that was kind of a central theme of it. As Christians, maybe sometimes we make some assumptions of people on the left that we need to re-examine too, and try to see the best in them. Take it, Rush. Silver
Bell. Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Colossians 3:17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back, all. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. At Tactics Radio would be the Twitter handle. And we've got a caller on line one. Let's go to Miss Daisy. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. And good morning to all the listeners, and Happy New Year and Christmas to all. I want to say this, and this is from my heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God put you on this earth for a purpose. I would just listen to your dialogue. I tell you, I'm going to say this plain words so a person will understand what I'm saying. You're a good person.
Well, thank you.
You're a good person. You're young, but not too many young persons. say the words that need to be said like you.
Well, thank you. I greatly appreciate that.
Your parents have done an excellent job with you, but it was God first. And I want you to continue to do what you're doing. God's going to bless you more. That's the reason why you're getting well, because he know what you believe. You don't have pick and choose when it come down to conversation about persons. And I love you for that.
Well, I love you too, Miss Daisy, and I appreciate it.
God's going to bless you, dear. You take care, and don't eat too much Christmas now.
I'll try not to.
Okay, sweetie.
I don't want to get more sick, so.
Thank you, sweetie.
Thanks, and a Merry Christmas to you. It's always good to hear from you. So thank you so much, Miss Daisy, for the kind words there. And I really do think that it really all does boil down to there was a time in this country where when it started getting closer to Christmas time, and I think there's still an element of this. I think that there are people that still really hold to this. There was a level of kindness and courtesy that kind of went up around the month of December. Because I guess it's just because of the time of year where people do start reflecting and talking about it, that even people that they may not even necessarily always get along with at work or in their town or whatever it may be, that because it was the holiday season, their kindness level went up just a little bit. And I think that that's a really good thing, that it should be up all the time, and I understand that, and I appreciate that. But at the same time, it seems like now we all get in such a rush and everybody's trying to get whatever present it is or, you know, get to wherever they need to go, that there's almost an extra level of rudeness that we go in almost the opposite direction. But kindness matters. And assuming the best in other people does matter. And that's what I was trying to really get across with that last segment. And I hope that we can all take that to heart as well. Now, I do want to go to something, unfortunately, that's not quite as lighthearted, not quite as uplifting, but I do think that it is something that is important that needs to be talked about. There is a case that just broke this week of a New York woman who claims that her then-boyfriend spiked her drink with an abortion pill, put it into her tea, which ended her 17-week pregnancy at the time. Now, when he originally found out about the baby, that she was pregnant, and he knew that it was his, of course, he pressured her to get an abortion, and she refused. So when she went to talk to him about that and how they were going to sort all this out, when he fixed her tea, he gave her four times the recommended dosage of this abortion pill, put that in her tea, and when she drank it, she unfortunately lost the child shortly thereafter. And they found the drug in her system, so they confirmed that she had that dosage in her. Now, in the wake of all this, he's being charged with killing the child. And the question that I really have with this is, what the father in this case did, I mean, drugging somebody is a crime, and I understand that, but the charge specifically is that he killed the baby growing inside of her. And so why is it that when we look at abortion, if the mother decides to kill the child, if she decides that she wants to kill the baby that's growing inside of her, then that's just her right to choose, and that's something that must be protected and revered and something that she has to have available to her. But when the father decides on his own that he wants to kill the child, like he did in this situation, why is it okay then? Why is it all of a sudden that this isn't a guy's right to choose when he unilaterally does something that kills his own baby? Why is he not afforded that same quote-unquote right? And I'm using that in air quotes because, of course, I don't believe a woman does have a right to kill her own child. But why is it there's a difference viewed there? Even Caitlin Borgman of the ACLU's Reproductive Freedom Project recognized that there is a large inconsistency here. She said, ultimately, if harming a fetus is criminal in one context, why wouldn't it be in another? Now, granted, when it comes to Borgman, she's essentially asserting that we should remove all rights afforded to the unborn because there is an inconsistency there. So in other words, if you're doing that, then there should be no criminal action taking place. But what I'm saying is, even she recognizes that there is a huge inconsistency here. That harming an unborn child in one situation is being charged as though it's a homicide, but the other is not. And this is the problem that you constantly run into when looking at cases like this, is that any time that you draw an arbitrary line that doesn't start at conception, you are being inconsistent in some way. Because the only real difference in an unborn child and one that has already been born, you can draw that line somewhere else after birth if you draw it before birth. If you say that what determines life, for example, when the clip that we played with Ben Shapiro a few months ago was sentience, or at the very least potential sentience, then there's somebody that is already alive, that has already been born, that everyone would agree, or at least the vast majority of society would agree, is wrong to kill and that they have a right, that same standard would apply to, like somebody in a coma. If you're going to draw the line at size, because babies are smaller in the womb, obviously, than they are when they're born, then do short people have less rights than larger people? If you're going to draw it at level of development, well, what about people that have disabilities that are underdeveloped, that don't have that same level of development and can't reach that same level of development as an adult? If you're going to do level of dependency, well, there are people that are on life support, people that have machines hooked up to them that allow them to stay alive. Do they have less rights? If you're going to look at location, well, does that mean the value of life is different in some places than it is in others? Let's look, for example, at the viability argument. This is one that gets argued a lot, that if a baby is viable, in other words, it can survive outside the womb, then that's the standard at which life begins. But if viability is the issue, and that's the case, then that means some babies have more rights earlier than others do. It's an inconsistent standard again, because some babies can survive outside the womb if they live in a country that has really nice medical facilities that can handle something like that, to where there are other babies that will barely be able to survive outside the womb because their countries haven't advanced as much. Their medicine hasn't advanced as much. Are they less valuable, even though they're the same age and the same level of development and everything else, just because their viability is different in different places? And that's another thing, too, is medical technology advances. Why do rights all of a sudden start coming faster? There's nothing else in the... There's no other right that comes based upon how quickly you can survive them. In other words, we wouldn't say that someone has freedom of speech at this point, but then medical technology advances a certain degree, and then we say, well, now they have it at this point. Again, unless that line starts at conception, when a person has their own unique set of DNA, you are drawing an inconsistent standard, and that's the problem that you run into when arguing this. And this is the problem with the left, is that, again, they are drawing an inconsistent standard. They're essentially saying the only thing that really matters when it comes to determining whether or not a baby is alive or a baby has rights is the mother. The mother's the only thing that matters. How she feels about it, whether she wants the baby or not. If you want a perfect example, you remember that there was a lot of hype and a lot of news coverage, that kind of thing, about when the baby was going to be born to the, I think she's a duchess. I don't really understand how England's political system works, but Kate. And then there was this hashtag that came out called Royal Baby, and all the people on the left were talking about it and talking about the baby. And at one point, there were even Democrat politicians that are adamantly pro-choice that were referring to it as the royal baby. So it's a baby when the mom wants to be pregnant, but it's a fetus when it's not? That it's just a clump of cells? And let's just take that for example. This is one expression that I hear all the time from the left. They say, well, it's just a clump of cells. Yeah, and so are you. Everything your body is composed of is a cell. That's basic biology. So if you're going to say because it's a clump of cells, it's not worth protecting the rights of, Well, you're a clump of cells, too. That's what all humans are. That's what all living beings are, is we're a very large collection of cells. That doesn't mean you don't have rights. I mean, is a baby a clump of cells? Sure. Is it a smaller clump of cells than you? Yeah, but again, then we're back to the size argument. See, this is the problem that you have. You keep running in circles because if you set that inconsistent standard, it always comes back to somebody who has already been born that you can draw that same line with. And that's what we're running into right here. I'm going to break down this argument a little bit further when we come back. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. Before we go to the break, though, I do want to tell you about our good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. These guys have been in business for 50 years now. They're incredibly good at what they do. They know vehicles inside and out, whatever it is that you need. They can take a look at it. They can figure out what's wrong with it. Or they can recommend you to somebody who does on the off chance. But believe me, I've been throwing problems at these people left and right. My truck Clyde he's got about 240,000 miles on him, so he has some issues. I have to bring him in, you know, on a pretty regular basis. But every time that I have, they've been able to figure out what the problem is and handle it themselves. They're experts. That's why they've been in business for 50 years. They offer great services at a great price, and they're going to give you a good deal. Go by, see them today. On the Troy Highway, that is Woodham, Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The name of the Lord, says the scripture, is a strong tower. Thither the righteous flee and are safe. Let us secure his favor, and he will lead us through the journey of this life and, at length, receive us to a better. Samuel Adams.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, you can also tweet me at Tactics Radio. Plenty of ways to get in touch with me. Facebook, another way. You can go to Facebook.com/Tactics Radio. You can get in touch with us that way as well. So there's no shortage of ways to get involved with the show. Now, I want you to follow this line of thinking down its logical trail. For those of you who may be just joining us, we were talking about a case in New York where a woman is now charging a man with killing her child because he spiked her drink with an abortion pill. And so this is the logic that you're going down, where people are asserting that the only thing that makes a difference in whether or not an unborn child should be protected, that it has rights, that you can be charged for terminating its life, is that whether the mother wants it or not, that is the standard. It's a very, very dangerous line of thinking, and I'm about to show you why. If you follow this line of thinking to its logical conclusion, and this is something that's a common debate tactic, it's something that you do to explore, you take a person's idea, kind of take it for a test drive, and see where you end up. That if you are to follow this line of thinking, the premise that has been presented, the worldview that they are presenting it in, you follow that to its natural conclusion and see if that conclusion is a place that you want to go or not. And so let's go ahead and sort of take this line of thinking for a test drive, that the child's value, whether or not it lives or dies and whether or not it has rights or doesn't have rights, are all contingent upon the mother, whether or not she wants to raise the child or not, or not even raise. I mean, it could be adoption or something else, but she wants to carry the child to term or not. So if an unborn child only has value based on the mother's desire for it to have value, where does that lead us? Where do we wind up? Does her infant no longer have value if she decides that she no longer wants it? Now, there are some people on the pro-choice side of this that actually would say no. There is a movement that has been going on in Europe to where they are considering, now granted, this hasn't gotten anywhere near majority yet, so really there are a lot of people that are against this, even in Europe. I'm not trying to give the impression that people over in the UK and France and everywhere are on board with this, but there is a movement, it's small, but it is there, that say that really until the child starts talking, you can terminate its life. That once it gains the ability of speech, then its life starts having value. But any time before that, you can kill it without any consequence. That you should be able to kill an infant maybe up to 1.5, 2 years old before it starts talking. And as long as you do it before that point happens, it's not murder. There are really people that believe that. Are people with disabilities no longer valuable if their parents don't want them? This is, again, something that has happened in human history. There's not really much of a movement with it now. There are some, though. In fact, there was a video in, I want to say it was maybe Denmark. Just saw this not too long ago. It's a European country, an industrialized country, a developed country, where they're sitting there and talking with a guy that has Down syndrome. And they're talking about how expensive it is to keep him alive and saying that the only other people that even come close are the sick and very elderly. And so this is part of the reason that Iceland, for example, has gone through abortion, and with early screening, they have a zero Down syndrome birth rate. The reason they have is because they've just aborted everybody that they've detected that has Down syndrome because they're so expensive to keep alive. So a person's right, their value to live, in some places is now being considered based on the contingency of how developed somebody is. So I guess as long as the person with disabilities isn't wanted by their family, then logically you could assume that just like abortion, if that desire is not there and your value is based upon that, then we can kill people that have disabilities. Okay, are the sick and elderly just too much trouble to keep alive? If it's somebody that, like I said, is dependent on machines, maybe someone on an iron lung or something like that, even if there is a good chance that they will reawaken, is that person just, does their life just no longer have value? If the family doesn't want them and the person is incapable of taking care of themselves, is it okay to just kill them? Is your life's value contingent upon the will of others? That's really what this all boils down to. Now, all of the things that we're talking about, that we just followed that idea to its natural conclusion and saw where it leads us, this isn't just some scary dystopian thing that I'm throwing out there. All of these things have happened in the past before. In actual human history, multiple times, life has not always been valued. For example, you can look at ancient Egypt, story right out of the Bible, where the Hebrew children, because they were worried about overpopulation and the Hebrews outnumbering the Egyptians, that there was a mass genocide of all the male children under two. You could look at Russia with the Soviet Revolution, systematic starvation of parts of its population because the collective, the group, did not want them. You can look at Germany, the Weimar Republic, and right afterward with what started with Nazi Germany. Keep in mind, the Nazis didn't start with the Jews. They didn't start just shipping Jews to different concentration camps and start gassing them. They started with baby Nauer, a baby that was severely disabled. They started with other people that were disabled and convinced the families that it was really more humane for them to go ahead and end that person's life. And as long as they convinced the family, they were okay with it. And then they moved on to other groups, the elderly, the people that couldn't provide for themselves, and eventually whole races of people like the Jews and the Roma. So that's where that leads if you follow that logic to its natural conclusion. You see, the standard of life must be protected at all levels because that's where the consistency lies. And once you have that, once that is a foundational part of your society, then that's something that shouldn't be taken away. Unfortunately, what we have done is we've muddied the water. We've taken that standard that used to be considered clear as day and, well, frankly, we've taken it to where that standard no longer exists, or at least doesn't exist the way we would think of it. It's done in such a way that it is inconsistent, because if a person's value is just based on whether someone else wants you alive or not, there's going to be an awful lot of people that won't be able to retain their life. Human beings are inconsistent. And when you base something like this on how another person feels about it, you can't have the standard of someone's life based on how they feel about you, because feelings change. Life must be protected at all levels, period. Because if it's not, a danger to life somewhere is a danger to all life everywhere. You can't devalue life. It ends up bad. Hour two coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
There's a company in the news for doing something good, which is a refreshing change of pace. We go there now on Tactics.
Bells will be ringing. This sad, sad news. Oh, what a Christmas to have the blues. My baby's gone.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. It is hour two coming up, and I'm sure that pretty much everybody at this point has heard about this. I've been sitting on this story actually for a couple of days, but I did want to get it in because it is a good feel-good story, especially for the holiday season. You all heard about the massive Atlanta airport blackout a few days ago. Thousands of flights delayed. It was such a big deal that the Atlanta airport was still having problems with their flights 2 and 3 days afterward because of how much it offset everything. Atlanta, of course, being one of the largest major airports in the country. And Delta especially, I think they lost millions and millions of dollars now asking the airport to pay for it. So the whole thing was a huge mess, especially with everybody traveling around this time of year. And it just wound up being a huge disaster and something that really hurt a lot of people, stranded a lot of people, that kind of thing. There were hundreds of people in the airport just stranded with nowhere to go because they were expecting to be on an airplane and they couldn't move. And here's another thing, too, that a lot of people didn't think about. The power was out for everything. Everything. So it wasn't just the planes trying to keep everything organized. One thing that was really problematic is that the people that were stranded there, they didn't have anything to eat because all the restaurants were closed. They didn't have any power to cook any of the food, so there were a lot of really hungry people stuck at the airport. So there was Chick-fil-A, which of course is closed on Sunday, that they had Chick-fil-A open their doors, and the off-site Chick-fil-A's cooked a bunch of food and brought it there for the people that were stuck in the airport. Because they couldn't cook it there, like I said, the power was out. So there were other Chick-fil-A's that opened up their doors, started cooking the food, and brought it over, which I thought was really good. It was a really cool story. Chick-fil-A broke its Sunday rule and delivered lunch to hungry people there, even though they're pretty dead set in their rule about not opening on Sundays. One thing I love about this company is it just seems like they're always there to help people out. You remember the story in Hurricane Harvey where you had the elderly couple where they called the Chick-fil-A and ordered a couple of chicken sandwiches and a couple of boats, and these two guys with jet skis showed up and literally drove the jet ski out their front door because their house was flooded. And Chick-fil-A is the one that kind of orchestrated that whole thing when they called them and asked for it. And then you also have the story in the snowpocalypse that happened a couple years ago, where Chick-fil-A was feeding hungry people that were stranded from the interstate that had nowhere to go and just needed somewhere to sit down, and they just gave them free meals to help them out. That's what I love about this company is it's not enough that they just espouse Christian beliefs and say that they're a Christian company. They actually live it out. They do it. They're not open on Sunday, even though I know that they would make profits if they were. And they do things like this that help people out. It's a really good company, and I don't mind giving them a little free publicity because of that. One thing I wanted to allude to here as well, this reminds me of a Bible story. And we're all familiar with it. Just about everybody knows about it. Even people that aren't Christians know about this story. It's the Good Samaritan from Luke 10, 30 through 37. Not so much the Good Samaritan himself, but look at the first few verses there where it talks about the man who is beaten and he's been mugged and left on the side of the road for dead. That story could have gone the way that the Samaritan just goes there and picks him up. Christ could have done the story like that, but he didn't. See, when Christ did this story, he mentions that there are two other men that saw the guy and just walked on past. And it was a priest and a Levite, two people that should have known better, that should have been following the law of God, who are people that you would think would profess to help somebody like this. And yet it was a Samaritan whom people didn't expect that helped this man out. Now, the reason I bring that up is maybe the priest and the Levite felt that they had some important religious duty to fulfill. Maybe they were on their way to give a sermon or teach a lesson or oversee some kind of religious ceremony for the people that they serve. And they felt like that was too important for them to stop and help this poor man. The Samaritan didn't. The Samaritan saw that as being the highest priority, that there was somebody that needed him help and he was going to help them no matter what. I think that this really proves the attitude that the people at Chick-fil-A had. Yeah, we're closed on Sunday and that's the rule. But they're hungry people that need our help. And that's more important. You see, I think that that parable was directed when Christ told it at the Pharisees in a lot of ways. Because remember how the Pharisees reacted to Christ. They rebuked him for gathering food, and I use that loosely, on the Sabbath day. Because he and his disciples were hungry. So they went through a field and just grabbed some pieces of wheat and rolled it around in their hand and snacked on them, because that's all they had. And they rebuked Christ for doing so, saying that he was harvesting on the Sabbath. And his response was, have you not read that it was David who ate the showbread in the temple when that's all he had because he was on the run from Saul? Only the priests are supposed to eat that. That's what's lawful. When there are people in need, that becomes the greatest priority. Same thing with the Sabbath on healing people. There were Pharisees, think about this, that were actually upset at Jesus for healing people's ailments on the Sabbath day. They were saying that that was work. And yet, Christ turns around and says, isn't the Sabbath a day where we're supposed to do good to one another? Isn't that kind of the whole purpose of the Sabbath? That we're supposed to help and heal and do the right thing and focus on God? What better way to do that than to heal somebody, to give them their life back? I mean, it's not like Jesus exactly exerted himself in doing so anyway, but the point is that the greatest law, as Christ himself says, is to love God with all your heart, soul, and mind and obey him. And the second is to love your neighbor as yourself. Those take precedence, always. And so I do think that there is a lesson for us to take out here. Yeah, it's good to see people and organizations help one another, but we need to be this as well. That when we see somebody in need, maybe our lives are busy, maybe there is something that we see as being really important and probably a good thing. But helping out God's children needs to always come first. That needs to always be our priority. If there's someone in trouble and we have the opportunity to help them, then that needs to be something that we consider because we have a responsibility to do so. That's the kind of people that we really should be. That's the kind of people we should be striving to be. Because it's the kind of people God commanded us to be. And like Jesus said in the last part of Matthew 24 and 25, when we help out people in Christ's name, it's as though we're helping Christ himself. It's as though we're coming and helping him and feeding him and doing right by him. So let's focus on that this season. 860-1440 are the numbers. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 1:21, for to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. You can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. That is an option that is available to you. So plenty of ways to get in touch with us on the air this morning. Now, I do have a special treat for you. I wasn't sure we were going to be able to pull this off, but we did, and I'll explain that in a second. We have Joe Hunk on the line right now. So, guys, it is time for Upon Further Review.
After review, we're rooting on the field.
If you can talk sports, you can talk with any guy in the world.
When sports and politics meet, it deserves a second look.
After further review, the player disqualification is reversed.
Here with the ruling, it's Caleb Colquitt and Sports Radio 740's Joe Hunk with Upon Further Review.
That's right. We've got Upon Further Review on right now with Joe Hunk joining us from his vacation, taking time out of his vacation to be with you this morning. Welcome into the program, Joe.
Hey, man, not a problem at all. I'm just sitting here watching the Doctor Who marathon, so I'm good to go.
Well, it's good to know you're not wasting your time on vacation.
Oh, no, man. My vacation's been fun, man. I've watched four different movies. I've seen Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. I watched Star Wars on Monday, Justice League on Tuesday, Thor Ragnarok on Wednesday. And today I'm just chilling out watching Doctor Who, getting ready for the Christmas special coming up on Monday. I'm good, man.
Man, all great movies, every single one of them we talked about on the show here. But I want to get your opinion on this story, for those of you who may not know. Former Arkansas running back and Dallas running back with the Cowboys, Darren McFadden. So back in 2013, we've been talking about Bitcoin a little bit on the show. Back in 2013, the guy told his financial investor he wanted him to invest $3 million in Bitcoin. Now, based on that and the price of Bitcoin that it is now, the amount that he would have gotten in return on that would be $273 million.
Kind of hurts your heart, doesn't it?
A little bit, because here's what happened for those of you who haven't heard this story yet. His financial advisor basically just said, yeah, I didn't invest the money. I just kind of held on to it.
Yeah, he held on to it, and he used it for himself.
Right.
And, I mean, okay, first off, okay, let's start the genesis of this, because Bitcoin is just now becoming really big. Like, and here's the thing. I don't know what Bitcoin is. I don't, based on what I've read, like, it's universal money or something. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a cryptocurrency. Basically, Bitcoin is a digital currency that was invented, and the way that it works, it's not a currency that is run by any one government. It's basically run by the internet.
Right. So it's becoming a new fad. Like, you know, we get, you know, Caleb and I both get these emails, and these emails are, you know, would you like to interview this person about this current hot topic in society and all this? And, you know, sometimes we're like, okay, that's not really a hot topic. You're just pressing something. And then there's other times where we get one that says, would you like to interview this person about Bitcoin? And I'm like, what on earth is this? Because I continue to hear about it. And again, there are certain people, and I say this is, you know, there are people that save their money. They're the NFL players when it comes to the way that they decide to spend their millions and millions of dollars. There's some that want to invest in cars, and they want to invest in big houses, and, you know, they want to have these huge game rooms so all the guys can come over and hang out with the 80-inch plasma, well, not plasma anymore, but 4K TV. They want to have all this stuff. Then there's other guys that try to be smart with their money.
Right.
And
because they know that, I mean, the average NFL career is about 4 years. So, I mean, they're not, the odds are they're not going to have that for very long.
No, but majority of the time, if you get two contracts, let's just go with this, two contracts. Let's think of it this way. Most people are only going to get two. You're going to get the one that you get whenever you're drafted, which is now based on a pay scale that has been governed by the NFL because, you know, guys like Matthew Stafford, when he came out of the league, was making more than anybody else on the team, and he had never played an NFL down. Now, he's earned his money, but some guys don't. And you look at some players, they'll get two contracts. Now, if you are in the lower side of this, your guys that are getting drafted in the third or fourth round, they're not getting paid the same amount of money that a guy that's getting in the first round's getting. So their second contract if they even get to a second contract, is going to be the one that gets them a lot of money a lot of times if they're a player that's valued in the NFL. For most NFL players in the first or second round, it's the first contract, and at times they'll get a really solid second one, but it may not be as good as what they're currently getting. You have to be smart with this money. Mm-hmm. And there's some players in the NFL that are really awesome because, you know, you'll hear of some guys that still drive the same car that they had in high school. You know, they're still driving it because they're not going to waste all their money. They're living in a basic apartment. They're being very smart with the money because they know that if they start saving it now and they put it into a savings account, CD, all this other financial stuff that financial advisors are supposed to help them with, they realize that this money that they're making in this 3 or 4 year span is going to be able to set up not only themselves for life, it's going to be able to set up their kids, it's going to be able to set up grandkids, they'll be able to buy mom a house, like all this other stuff, if they're smart with their money. That's why they get a financial advisor.
Right, and it's good, and that's one of the things, these guys, there are financial advisors that specifically specialize in helping guys like this, and they try to, I mean, there's a whole industry kind of built around it, honestly.
Well, because you have so many athletes, and I'll take one that I know, for instance, Jay Barker. We all know who Jay Barker is in the state of Alabama, okay? And he's on one of our sister stations up in Birmingham, Jocks 94.5, where I came from. Jay gets a salary from what he does for Jocks. The only thing is, Jay also invests his money into companies. And he invests his money invests his money in insurance companies. He also, for a time, and I don't know if this is still the case or not, he owned a burger restaurant at the Summit in Birmingham, which is making him more money. Like,
right.
They're trying to find ways to invest this money, and they block a side of this off. Like, you know, we all heard, now obviously I don't think that's the case now, that Tiger Woods doesn't spend any of his golfing money. The money that he makes from his tournaments, he, you know, uses the money from his endorsements, or vice versa, where he just uses the money that he makes from the golfing tournaments and the money that he makes from his endorsements he was saving. Like, you know, it's that sort of stuff. But the only problem is that really, unless you go to school for this, where you are somebody that loves math. Like, I love math. Math is one of my favorite, obviously, with being in the sport that I'm in.
Right.
We use math a lot.
Right.
So
baseball is definitely a statistic nuts dream.
Oh, yeah. And trust me, you know, everybody can get emotional until you start throwing math into it where the numbers don't match up. Then there's no emotion whatsoever. You know, you can talk about, well, this guy right here is, you know, this guy sucks. Well, really, you know, let's take Alabama Clemson, for instance.
Yeah.
Well, Alabama's played Clemson twice, and they're not going to go out there. They're going to go out with emotion, all this. But the fact is that Clemson has one of the best sack ratios in the NCAA. They sack the quarterback more times than anybody else in the country.
Right,
and
Joe, it goes back to something you've probably heard me say on the air a million times. Facts don't care about your feelings.
No, exactly. Look, facts are facts for a reason. Now, obviously, you can spin them and you can look, and everybody
sure.
can counter with, well, you know, they were playing Wake Forest and they were playing Syracuse, which did beat them, by the way. They were playing Virginia. Well, again, Alabama, you know, was playing Vanderbilt. Alabama was playing Fresno State. Like, for Alabama was playing Colorado State. Like, you can look at this and spin it, but the fact is, numbers are what they are. A lot of people aren't good with numbers. So the financial advisor is a great thing. The only problem is you don't get a financial advisor that's been a family friend for a while. You don't
mix
family and business. That's the whole thing. If I'm going to hire somebody like LeBron, people have bashed LeBron James because his buddies run his company. Like, his friends that have been his friends since he was in high school are the ones that run the company. Now, in LeBron James's world, it's kind of working, okay? He's one of the very few examples of where it actually works, because majority of the time you have to make a change. Let's look at college football, for instance.
Sure.
How many times do they change offensive coordinators? Well, every once in a while you got to get a fresh voice in there. Unless you're Auburn, then you get a guy that says the same thing. If you get in with this, you have to bring in somebody with new eyes that can look at things differently and can freshen things up. At some point in time, you're going to have to fire your friends, and that's going to strain the relationship. Why you go to a family friend to be your financial advisor is beyond me. If it's business, I want somebody that's good at business. I don't want somebody that's good at hanging out at my house and my parents know him.
And here's the rub for me, because I'm just imagining how this guy, because he didn't know about this until just recently. You know, he's got to be excited. He's watching Bitcoin, watching the price climb, thinking about how much money he's going to make because he got into it early. And, I mean, one day he just calls his financial advisor, hey, based on what I'm seeing, $273 million. And then the
guy's just like,
about that. I kind of didn't invest that.
No. And the way he found out was because the guy tried to sell him a building he already owned. Is that right?
He's trying to cover his tracks, and I'm just thinking, like, that's got to be such a massive letdown to think you've got this massive nest egg just sitting there, and then it's not there.
$200 million.
That's a quarter of a billion.
Look, Darren McFadden, as great as he was at Arkansas, he was considered a bust, and he is considered a bust in the NFL because of the injuries that he got in Oakland, mainly because, and one of the biggest factors that I go into the NFL draft is, he got drafted high by a crappy team. Well, when you get drafted high by a crappy team, they're going to utilize their superstar, and he didn't have an offensive line that could block for him, and he kept getting injured. Look at Trent Richardson at Cleveland. Trent Richardson was great for like a year, but then because of the amount of times that he was handed the football from the Cleveland Browns, he was injured. He was never the same running back ever again. Like, and these guys that get drafted high, majority of the time they go to a crappy team. The reason why Carolina is only good right now is because Cam basically looked at his offensive line and said, screw it, I'm just going to have to run around because you guys can't block for crap, and you still can't block for me. And that's the only reason why the Carolina Panthers have like 9 or 10 wins now, is because Cam finally said, you know, he started saying, I'm going to be a passing quarterback. I want to stay back. I don't want to run as much. I want to save my body. Well, then he was getting destroyed. He said, all right, screw it, I'm just going to have to run.
Right. Well, I mean, if you're going to risk injury anyway, why not?
Yeah, exactly. So that's the reason why Darren McFadden has been a bust, because he didn't have an offensive line that can block for him. So financially, he hasn't been the guy that you would want to invest a ton of money into. But he thought he was making a good business decision and making enough money in Bitcoin, which, again, in the last 10 minutes, I still haven't 100% understood this thing. But he's been able to invest his money in something, or he thought he was, that was going to give him more money for the rest of his life and for the rest of his grandkids and great-grandkids' lives than he ever would have made in the NFL. Like, a $200 million is franchise quarterback-type money. Like,
oh, yeah,
his body
absolutely
wasn't going to be beat up. His mind wasn't going to be destroyed from concussions and all we're thinking of was CTE. None of that. He was going to be set, and he actually made a great decision. He didn't invest it in a local restaurant. He didn't invest it in some clothing line that he thought was going to take off and bust it. He literally invested in a company and thought he was making $200 million. I don't even know what to do with $200. He had $200 million of those that he thought and found out that he didn't.
Yeah, I can't even imagine the letdown with that. And we're actually going to talk about something else involving a large sum of money, not quite as large as $273 million, that has to do with Auburn. So some local news. We got you on for one more segment, right, Joe?
Of course you do. What am I doing? Again, I've got Doctor Who on me.
All right. Well, we'll be back with Joe Hunk in just a second.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers, as always. If you want to call in, we got Joe Hunk back with us for our second segment of Upon Further Review. Now, we were talking about money in the last segment, and we're going to be talking about money this one. Jay Jacobs, of course, the athletic director at Auburn, the guy is on his way out after 30 years, and you've got in this guy's record, and help me out, Joe, if I miss any of these, the softball debacle, everything that's going on right now with the investigation with Chuck Person and the basketball program, very questionable contract extensions that cost Auburn a lot of money, like with Gene Chizik, and the revolving door of baseball coaches, which we can never seem to get a coach that works for our baseball team where we can actually be competitive in the SEC. So,
and people forget about the Spice one as well. Remember all the Spice stuff that happened with Gene Chizik? And
Oh, right, yeah.
What was it? Is it, was it E60 or was it 30 for 30? No, it wasn't 30 for 30. Was it like, I forget if it was E60 or 60 Minutes that did the Spice stuff and that sort of thing that, you know, and obviously everything that went down with that. That's another one that's more on the lesser scale now compared to what's happened with softball and basketball.
Right.
There's other ones that we've been told about and we've heard rumored to happen, but have yet to still come out. So that one we can't talk about, but it has been, as far as the play between the lines, let's emphasize it, the play on between the lines, whether it's baseball, softball, whether it's on the court with basketball, it's been very subpar, okay? It's been extremely subpar.
For a school like Auburn especially, yeah.
Well, and you look at the way the SEC is going right now and the amount of money that they're going to be getting. I mean, you and I spend a lot of time over on Auburn's campus. I mean, there's cranes everywhere. There's all this money that's coming in from all these deals that are building things around the campuses, around the campus. Like, it's, you know, you're getting a lot of residuals when it comes to it, and you're starting to see – well, again, let's look at what could possibly be happening with Gus Malzahn, which we know the rumor of a football-only facility for the football team. We know the old track. We know where it could possibly go. That's another it's a great recruiting tool. And you see the developments that are starting to be built around Jordan-Hare Stadium. People don't realize this, you know, but where the press box is now going to be like suites and stuff. They're changing those over.
Right, because they're building that new press box over the north end zone there.
Exactly, which I will say personally, that sucks, okay? Because the press box is where I'm going to be sitting. We can't see the board. Like, you can't see the huge Jumbotron anymore. You should have at least
right, because it's basically behind it.
Yeah, it's parallel with it. Like, there may be people that are on the far left side that may be able to see a little bit, but could you not have put the press box on the other side? But the problem is that the press box now is going to be on top of these recruiting rooms and in the locker room and all that stuff that Auburn is starting to build up around Jordan-Hare. So that's the reason why it couldn't be on the opposite side, because there is nothing over there as far as the team is concerned.
Right, and speaking of this, the reason that I did all this and talked about Jay Jacobs' career and set that up is that even with that track record, the retirement systems of Alabama have released how much Jay Jacobs is going to be making in retirement when he retires.
Did it just say bank? Did it just say bank? Like, is that what it just said? It didn't give you a number. It just said, oh, he's going to be making bank.
That's what it should have said, because here's the amount he will be making annually. $540,000 a year. That's $45,000 a month.
Yes. In my current pay scale right now, I won't make $540,000. I would probably say in the next 10 to 12 years.
Right.
Maybe. It may even be longer than that, maybe 15 years.
But think about that. Considering what Jay Jacobs has done over the course of his career, and he's basically being forced out of he's being forced to retire basically because of the scandals, he's still going to be making $500,000 a year.
Well, and this is the problem. This is the problem with any public office. Okay, let's emphasize this, because that athletic director position is a public position at a public university. Okay,
right. It's a state university.
Exactly, it's a state university. It's just like, you know, on 740, we talk so much about Bill Clark and his time at UAB and the fact that he was, from his time coaching in Prattville to the time that he was coaching at Jack State to what he's done now at UAB. He was trying to stay there long enough so that he can get on this retirement plan that the state of Alabama has for its teachers and public employees and all this sort of stuff. Okay, so if you look at this, it's the exact same reason why younger people, which, by the way, I didn't even know that if I truly even wanted to go for a political position right now, I can't because I'm still too young. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yep, that's okay, a rule.
There's a reason, and I can say this on the radio station that I'm currently on, meaning the one here on Tactics,
right,
is that there's a reason why old farts don't want to leave this place, okay? There's a reason why old farts just want to fight so hard to be in political offices, that because they're making six figures on a job that they really just have to go around and shake a bunch of people's hands.
And if they want to make more, they can just vote for it.
Exactly. And they can, you can seriously go out and part of your job is to quote unquote go around and be around the people. Well, to do that, they get invited to all of these, you know, I call them hootie tootie, like all these little hootie tootie events where it's black tie affairs and there's all this fantastic meals. And because they're a public servant that has been invited, they get all this stuff for free.
Mm-hmm.
And the six figures that these people are making right down the street from where our studio is, there's a reason, because that's a job without ever actually having to do anything. Again, going back to what Darren McFadden was doing, they can save all this money and eventually invest it into all sorts of stuff where they're making bank after they're no longer elected anymore. There's a reason why you have all these people that we're voting on fighting so hard to get there, because it's a paycheck.
It's even worse at the federal level. I think you only have to serve two terms, maybe three, as a House representative, which is, that would just be 6 years if it's three. And one term as a senator, and you basically get all the benefits of that for the rest of your life, medical, everything.
Yes.
And so getting an office is like winning the lottery now.
Yes, and this is where it goes back to what we were talking about last segment with getting fresh and new voices in, okay? We are in a society now, and whether it's at your work, whether it's at your the current city you live and work in, whether it's at the federal level, you have so many people that have been there for so long,
mm-hmm,
that
like
they
Jacobs.
Never want to. Yeah, exactly. They never want to try new stuff. Okay, now Jay Jacobs, here's what's crazy about this. Jay Jacobs has been at his job for so long, but the problem is, and this is the only thing that where it makes Jay Jacobs different than any other sort of office that we're talking about inside of Montgomery or the state and federal level, is everything Jay Jacobs is doing has to appeal to a 16, 17, and 18-year-old kid. Okay, it's not trying to appeal to 30 and 40 and 50-year-olds. It's trying to appeal to a 16, 17, and 18-year-old kid to get them to want to come to the university. That's the only difference. So whenever it comes to, let's say in the federal office being on Twitter, okay, I know people that, heck, Caleb, I know people that you and I work with,
mm-hmm,
that still don't even know what Twitter is, okay? And I know that, but at the same time, Jay Jacobs can't be there because he's having to constantly change and update. That's the reason why you are seeing all these different things going up around the Auburn Athletic facilities. Because, and this is what people don't get, the facilities themselves are more important than the field the players play on. Okay? And let me emphasize this. From a former athlete, I remember I spent more time in our gym, in our batting cages, in our athletic facilities than I actually did on the field that we played on. Okay, so when you're talking about any athlete who only, let's say football, for instance, who's only going to play eight home games, maybe six most of the time, okay, six home games on that one field, that means 6 days out of 365, there's only 6 days that they're actually going to step on that field and it matters.
Mm-hmm.
Which one do you think is more important, those 6 days or the other 359 days? Yeah, 359 days that they're in the athletic facilities, that they're in the cafeteria, that they're in the film room.
Their dorms, all that.
That's why that stuff is more important. Now,
right.
Jay Jacobs is in a situation where he's different than federal employees, because federal employees are trying to appeal to 40 and 50 and 60-year-old people, i.e. the people that listen to this radio station, because
right.
they're all about making sure that those people are happy. They don't like change. The only problem is that people like Caleb and myself, we're the generation that has new ideas. And we keep getting shot down because the old farts that are in there that don't want change want to make sure that they're still making their six figures.
Right.
That's where the whole thing
and there's
is
this right, and there's this disconnect there, and Jay Jacobs is kind of a great symbol for that old guard kind of moving away, and hopefully they get somebody
the
in there with some
network.
New ideas.
You can go ahead, yeah, the good old boy club. We all know what it is.
No, we
all
know
what the good old boy. I mean, that's what it is you have a bunch of old guys that are hanging around, and if a new guy comes in and says, you know what, maybe we should do this, they're like, oh, you're stupid. No, we don't need to do that. Just the way it's worked like this for years, we need to go ahead and do it. By the way, I can guarantee you that in our listening audience right now, if there are people that are in their 20s and 30s, there are people in their 20s and 30s listening right now that have better ideas than probably half the people that are currently in political office right now. The only problem is they can't get into political office because of their age.
And part of the reason for that is because, you know, you do have that. There's nothing wrong with wisdom and experience and all that. But sometimes, even if the new idea doesn't have as much experience behind it, it needs to be heard, because if nothing else, you may be able to gain something out of it just getting a fresh set of eyes on it.
Oh yeah, no. Look, politics is the dirtiest game in the world. It is the most dirtiest game in the world, and that's the reason why a lot of people don't get into it. And you look at Jay Jacobs; he had this good old boy network that has backed him for so long that he didn't have to do anything. Like, he literally could get away with so much of this, and it allowed him to be a public servant, a member of this public university long enough that he is now going to be getting $500,000 a month mm-hmm. to not do crap, or $500,000 a year to not do crap. Like, it's ridiculous. I mean, heck, I wanted him out as athletic director, like, before he even stepped in. Like, it's been a joke the entire time that he's been at Auburn.
Well, I'm hoping, and I know that you are too, that with Jay Jacobs on his way out, and I do have to go to a break here in just a second, but hopefully that will be the start of something fresh, something new, and something that Auburn can take in a different direction. I hope that they'll take it that way and look for somebody with some new ideas. But honestly, considering Auburn's track record with that good old boy network, I rather doubt it.
Well, the good thing about this is that the good old boy network, I don't believe, is part of the search committee and the search firm that's going to bring the new athletic director in. And I don't think that the athletic director that's going to come in is going to have serious ties to Auburn. That's at least, you know, my belief, and from what I'm seeing, there's a couple candidates that do have small Auburn ties. Obviously, when you're looking at the lady that is with the NFL right now, she has connections to Auburn. But I really think that you're going to have somebody from the outside bringing fresh ideas in, which is exactly what they need.
Excellent. Well, I hope that is the case. Thank you so much, Joe, for being with us. We'll be right back with the Chaplain's Report.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 13:34-35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. The Chaplain's Report is up right now. In the religious world, there seems to be some tension between people who want to emphasize faith and grace more and some that want to emphasize works more. I've been the witness to these kind of debates myself. I've been involved in them myself. And so I thought that it was important to provide just a little bit of light to this subject, because sometimes more heat than light is generated. In Ephesians 2:8-10, "For by grace you have been saved through faith, and not of yourselves, it is the gift of God, not as a result of works, that no one may boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them." The Bible is pretty clear on this. You have to have both. Do works save you? Well, of course not. But that doesn't mean that they aren't required. God made us to do good work. That is our purpose in life. And that's part of the reason that he saved us. It's kind of like a man drowning and having a life preserver thrown at him. He still has to grab onto the life preserver to be saved. But is he the person that saved himself? Was him reaching his arm out the action that saved him? No, it was the person that threw the life preserver. So it is by grace through faith that we are saved. That is true. Ephesians is very clear on that. But works are also required and demanded by God. works are commanded, and so a person being disobedient to God, we would not say that a disobedient person or a rebellious person could be able to win God's favor. So when it comes to talking about grace and faith versus works, that's mischaracterizing the question. Asking which is more important is like asking whether a pen or a paper is more important in writing a letter. They're both different. They both contribute something other that's not the same as the other piece of equipment that you need to write a letter. But both are required. You have to have both to accomplish the purpose. And so, that being said, you obviously need to have both. They complement each other. We are saved for a purpose, and that purpose is to spread God's word and do good work, to have communion with Him, and doing good works is a part of that. Remember that grace and salvation are free gifts, and to whom much is given, Christ says much is expected. Because we have been given this great gift of eternal salvation to get to be with God forever, God expects a lot out of us, and that includes doing good to our fellow man. Something important to think about this season. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.